Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, they could call Cisco, they could call Piazza, they could call somebody else, but instead it's like, I'm going to call my farmer. I bet she has it.
Teresa Bertels is the on-call farmer to about 10 local restaurants. We visit her Heartland family farm and hear how her farming changed once she partnered with chefs. It looks funny, but it tastes delicious. Chef Daniel Orr throws together a salad with celery root. Then another root vegetable is paired with some smoked trout. A deadly disease is wreaking havoc on the American piglet population. Amy Mayer of Harvest Public Media tells us more. And now is the time to start thinking about what you'll plant in the spring. We talk seeds coming up. We followed three stories this week, one about the Walmart effect, and two about how to maybe get your kids to eat healthier. Louanne Johnson is here with details.
Last week, tomato pickers in Florida saw a victory when Walmart agreed to pay one penny more per pound of tomatoes. A penny more per pound may not sound like much, but it's the difference between $50 and $90 a day per worker for around 30,000 tomato pickers. The Coalition of Immokalee Workers signed on to the Fair Food Program in 2010, a partnership among tomato pickers, farmers, and the businesses who buy from them. Growers who don't adhere to the rules will not be allowed to do business with the companies who participate in the program. Walmart is the most visible of the chains that have signed on to the Fair Food Program, which includes Chipotle, Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, and Yum Brands. This step to protect tomato workers could have a ripple effect across the industry. Netting $466 billion in revenue last year, the multinational retail corporation has the ability to influence other businesses through its decision-making. Call this the Walmart effect. Walmart says it plans to expand the Fair Food Program to include other vegetable growers. A question on the minds of parents, nutrition experts, and educators. How do you convince students to choose fruits and veggies for lunch instead of sweets? A new study from Cornell University suggests the watchful eye of mom or dad is all the encouragement kids need. Parents who signed up for the study were emailed their child's weekly nutrition report card that listed the foods they selected during lunch. The students' choices were tracked electronically through modified cash registers. Results show that simply knowing their parents were monitoring their habits was enough to get students to pick fewer desserts and opt for vegetables and fruit more frequently. Cookie consumption alone dropped from 14.3% to 6.5%. One of the virtues of the nutrition report cards is they can be done electronically with little additional cost or time for school districts. However, the system cannot account for purchases at vending machines. And another story about food and youngsters. NPR reported this week on research that suggests when kids are allowed to serve themselves, they're less likely to overeat. They also tend to be more open to trying different kinds of foods. That echoes USDA recommendations that parents should let kids as young as two serve themselves at home. Meals should be served family style, where you present kids with a few different dishes and allow them to take what they want. Researchers note that this way of structuring meals might be tough for parents to accept. In addition to extra cleanup, it can be disconcerting to see kids pass on broccoli time after time. But they remind parents that kids have to be exposed to new foods 12 to 15 times before they learn to accept them. Find links to these articles in this week's podcast post. It's on eartheats.org.
And plenty of other news stories to discover on our Twitter feed. Connect with us at twitter.com/eartheats. Food news with Louanne Johnson. Have a good one.
Thanks. See you soon.
A virus that kills piglets is ripping through farms around the country. While it doesn't affect humans, Midwest pork producers are doing everything they can to fight it off. But as Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the disease is proving resilient.
At Harris Vaccines, a startup company in Ames, Iowa, Anya Doolittle and Victoria Jansen wipe clean small bottles containing a white milky liquid and then apply labels. They're shipping out vaccine for porcine epidemic diarrhea, or PED. There's urgency to the work. In a total swine herd of 66 million animals, PED is likely to blame for the deaths of about a million piglets. And that toll is rising. The virus first turned up in the U.S. last spring, but Harris Vaccines founder Hank Harris had been following its impact in parts of Europe and Asia, where efforts to quell it with vaccines have not been terribly successful.
The company was interested in developing a vaccine before the virus occurred in the United States, but as soon as it occurred in the United States, that increased our interest significantly.
Harris Vaccines and other veterinary companies are pumping out vaccines, scrambling to control the outbreak. But Harris says even his current vaccine isn't enough to protect all piglets in infected herds.
It's not giving 100% protection in those situations. And so that's why we have a Generation 2 vaccine that we're developing already.
Like Harris, Sabrina Swenson of the USDA's National Veterinary Services Laboratory knew PED was out there and could come to this country.
One of our roles is to try to anticipate potential things and look to make sure that we have diagnostics in place. And many years ago, we had a concern of the potential for PED to come into the United States.
And since its arrival, PED has been spreading relentlessly. Think of a preschool classroom where the children must wash their hands several times a day. Even so, when one gets a cold, quickly most do. And they tend to get sicker than their parents and teachers. Similarly, PED spreads fast within barns and from farm to farm, even when strict biosecurity measures, the hand washing of the livestock industry, are in place. That's because it can survive in tiny bits of manure that travel on boots or trucks. Adult pigs typically recover, but Iowa State University veterinary medicine professor Rodney Baker says baby pigs do not.
The pigs die from dehydration. The baby pigs just cannot withstand losing all their body fluids as fast as they do.
Once they're older than about 10 weeks, Baker says, pigs aren't nearly as vulnerable. But new winter litters remain at risk because the virus likes the cold.
It's easy to imagine that we could have lost 1 million pigs, and before the winter's over, I wouldn't be surprised that the impact could be maybe 3-4 times that.
As for consumers, it's not clear yet whether bacon and ham prices will go up. Too many other factors are also in play. But Baker says the ongoing outbreak could be a bonus for some farmers.
The good news is those farmers that keep the virus out, there's economic opportunity for them compared to those that, you know, fail to keep it out.
And he says it's the smaller independent producers, ones that have fewer hogs and minimal contact with other farms, who are having the most success. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration focused on issues of food, fuel, and field. More stories like this one at harvestpublicmedia.org. Heartland Family Farm sells to the farmers market and it runs a CSA, but its main business is custom growing for local restaurants, from fine dining establishments to quick serve joints. Farmer Teresa Bertels met one of her loyal chef customers, Dave Talent, when he was shopping at the farmers market. They started talking, and then Bertels turned the table on him.
And I started asking him, now, what are you looking for? What would you like for me to grow? And I think that was a little bit of a different angle also for him, because he was used to coming to the market to buy whatever was available at the market. And then to kind of change that scenario to where, oh, you know, a farmer's going to grow specific things for me.
She's been providing restaurant talent with food for 10 years now. Fostering this relationship has taken some work on her part, primarily in terms of what to plant when. Initially, it was hard for her to anticipate in December, when she's buying seeds, what a chef would want to plate up in August.
So when I start the season, let's say with a green bean, you know, I don't want to tell a chef the second week of June or the third week of June, oh, I've got 10 pounds of green beans for you. And then the next week, I've got another 10 pounds. And then, oh, sorry, I'm out of beans for the next 3 weeks.
She's not harvesting anything fresh from the ground right now. The kale and the Brussels sprouts held on through much of December. But now her attention is turned to preparing for the upcoming planting season. This is her first year farming on this particular plot of land. It's an old horse farm, so she says it's never been treated with chemicals. You hear that whistling? That's the wind, the strong, persistent wind that follows you wherever you go on these 40 acres. Location was the primary reason for buying this farm before she had a 23-mile drive to get into town.
But I wanted to be close to Bloomington, so when chefs call me and say, hey, I need 10 pounds of kale, hey, can you bring some eggs in? I am almost out of eggs. I wanted to be in the position where I can just jump on the road and exactly 14 minutes, I'm downtown.
Farming is in her blood. One of Bertel's earliest memories was walking barefoot through her grandparents' field picking potatoes. She's grown food ever since, but she started farming commercially 16 years ago. She needed a way to support herself following a divorce.
I just couldn't fathom staying indoors all day. I mean, to me, that was just like, I can't do that, but I can grow things. Excellent year. Excellent year. And then we have the bees, and they've been great. Oh, I see they're out this afternoon.
The bees?
See the bees?
Are they out because it's suddenly warm today?
Yes, they are.
And five happy chickens pecking away.
Yeah.
Actually, she has upwards of 100 chickens and a handful of sheep who are guarded by Katie the donkey.
Katie!
So what's the point of the donkey?
Oh, the point of the donkey is to keep the sheep alive. Oh, I can't tell you how many times I jump out of bed. One reason I leave the window open when I sleep is so I can hear the coyotes. Hi, how is everybody today? Hey, how's everybody doing, huh?
Inside her house, she has copies of Food and Wine and Gourmet next to her seed catalogs. She does a lot of reading to keep up on the food trends so she can grow the latest it ingredients. Pea shoots, for instance. When she started growing pea shoots, she was the only local source.
If you grow something different, something out of the ordinary, and you come to the back door of a kitchen and you call for your chef and he comes over and you show him this glorious thing that you've grown, I mean, they just light up like a Christmas tree. They're so excited because they are creative and artistic and you've given them a new color to go on the palette. You know, they could call Cisco, they could call Piazza, they could call somebody else, but instead it's like, I'm going to call my farmer. I bet she has it. So I really appreciate that.
Teresa Bertels and Heartland Family Farm provide food to almost a dozen local restaurants in southern Indiana. Pictures of our day on the farm at eartheats.org. Coming up...
You know, people that come from different ethnic backgrounds probably are more familiar with a lot of root vegetables than Americans. But, you know, the Europeans, one of the most fabulous things you can have are celery root.
They may look funny, but they sure do taste great. Parsnips and celery root on Chef Daniel Orr's menu.
A fella really got to eat. And a fella should eat right. 5 will get you 10. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread.
Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 4 locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at TouchstoneWellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com.
Thank you. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
These are not the prettiest looking vegetables necessarily.
Yeah, I think people are intimidated by the way they look. You know, people that come from different ethnic backgrounds probably are more familiar with a lot of root vegetables than Americans. But, you know, the Europeans, one of the most fabulous things you can have are celery root. The English have a dish called bubble and squeak, where they mix mashed potatoes and cabbage, and you know, you cook it in a pan until it kind of squeaks, and you can add some carrots or parsnips to that. The Belgians have a wonderful dish called strumpf, and that is potatoes and root vegetables that are kind of done in a coarse mash. The Polish people use a lot of turnips and rutabaga. You know, it's a way to stretch out your potatoes and things that you might buy from the supermarket with things that you grew in your garden. And the great thing about a lot of root vegetables is that they cold store for a long time, which means, you know, you can keep these things in your root cellar or in your salad crisper in the refrigerator, and they can last for months.
Chef Daniel Orr is making some parsnip pancakes coming up. But first, he's got a recipe for perhaps the ugliest-looking root vegetable of the lot. It's his celery root remoulade.
Or, in English, a celery root salad. Now, these things are really knobby-looking, and they do take a bit of work to prepare them. You can see that they have this...
Tentacles
on both sides. This you can. It almost looks like a little baby celery plant. If you smell that,
oh wow,
it's got a really nice celery aroma. So you cut off the top and the bottom, and then go down the side, and you just want to cut all the skin and the dirt away from it. If you're going to keep them around, if you want to do this a day ahead or 2 days ahead, put them in some water in the refrigerator, with a little bit of lemon juice, and that'll keep them nice and white until you want to use them. Use what we call a mandolin, and you could also just use your knife. What you want to do is a kind of a what we call a haystack or julienne. So you see they look like little matchsticks, or they also call it pompai, which means little straw sticks.
This is the second time in my memory that we've used this. We use this on the raw Brussels sprouts salad.
Yes.
This might be for show a little bit in the kitchen, but it's so handy. Look at how quickly you're making these little julienne.
Especially if you cook for a group. You know, generally, you could do the same thing. Let me show you with the knife. What you're going to do is just cut thin strips of the vegetable, whatever you're using, and then stack them up. And then just rock your knife back and forth. But the great thing about the mandolin, it's very quick, it's very uniform. You know that everything's going to be exactly the same size, so it will cook or marinate really consistently. All right, and then to make the salad, we're going to add about a half cup of creme fraiche. Okay, I'm going to add a little bit of lemon juice. Kosher salt, I like to use the kosher salt because it feels really good in my fingers. I can kind of measure things very easily. With our pepper, we grind our pepper every day here in a little spice grinder, so it's nice and fresh. Okay, we'll mix this in.
Big dollop of mustard?
Yeah, mustard. That's my hard-working mustard, but you could use a Dijon mustard or a little Pommeray mustard.
What makes your mustard hard-working?
Well, she's sassy. She's a hard-working girl, and she's got a lot of flavor, and she's got a little bit of crushed chili peppers in her and some horseradish.
Invite her to a party.
Right.
She'll be a good time.
Right, and we're going to add some tarragon. Now, I'm just going to rough chop that.
It's going to give us a little color to this dish.
Exactly. And you see, that's very, very simple. It's a nice way to try a new vegetable. Really, it has a lot of air to it. Really looks pretty and light. And I like to use any leftovers up in sandwiches. So you could, you know, if you're making a little pita pocket or something, you could throw some tofu or some roast turkey or something in there with a little bit of this celery root and give it a taste. That's it. Reminds me of France.
You can easily make this dish vegan by using our recipe for tofu, sour cream, gluten-free, vegan, vegetarian, and meat-loving recipes. Find a variety at eartheats.org. When I was talking to farmer Teresa Bertels for this show today, she was poring over seed catalogs. She likes to get her orders in as soon as possible after she receives the catalogs in November. That way, she'll be ensured to get all the seeds she wants before the rush really sets in late January through mid-March. That's the hectic time of year for seed companies.
Yeah, it's Jerry Gettle, and I'm at Baker Creek Seed Company in Mansfield, Missouri.
Baker Creek Seed Company sends out a thick catalog that you could spend hours flipping through. They collect all kinds of seeds from over 150 growers, and they test them on their farm before offering them for sale. I chatted with Jerry Gettle this time last year during a rare break from the warehouse. This seems way too early because for us here in Indiana, we're certainly going to get more snow here.
It definitely is for a lot of people in a lot of areas. But in some areas like Florida, you know, they already got tomatoes setting on. But, you know, the majority of the people want to get their orders in early so they make sure they get the seeds they want, because the last few years, especially the more unusual and interesting seeds, tend to sell out really quickly. Some of the seeds sell out in, you know, a month or less.
Wow. So have you already sold out of any seeds?
We have the blueberry blend tomato that we have this year in the catalog. It sold out very quickly. We didn't know how many would sell because it was new this year, and it sold out within probably 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow, it's not even February yet. That's incredible to me. What other trends are you starting to see with people buying seeds this year?
One of the biggest trends that continues, and it just seems to be being more and more a trend, is people growing their own food. You know, flower gardening has kind of lost some of its status. It used to be in the 60s and 70s and 80s, people were growing more flowers. And the last few years, the trend has totally reversed, and people are growing way more vegetables than flowers. Another trend probably is just people planting more and more variety and more produce to can. Like this year, our number one seller is a Boston pickling cucumber, which is a pickling type of a cucumber. And that's the first year we've ever had a pickling cucumber, you know, as our number one seller.
Mm-hmm. I flipped to the corn page in this book, and there was a little sidebar that talked about how difficult it is for you guys to get heirloom varieties of corn. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, our biggest challenge, you know, when we first started, it was relatively easy back in the late 90s. Most of the corn hadn't been contaminated, and there was still not, the majority of the corn wasn't genetically engineered in this country. But now even the ovum-pollinated and heirloom corns that are on the market, many of them, when we test them to see if we can list them in the catalog, come back contaminated with primarily Monsanto's, you know, GMO varieties, which are patented. So it's kind of limited the varieties we could sell. We've had to reduce the amount we sell each year, and it's been become more and more difficult to, you know, get pure seed to put in the catalog. That's basically what it comes down to.
So am I hearing you correctly that our heirloom varieties of corn, they're being threatened? We could no longer have them?
It's definitely becoming more and more of a challenge, and we've definitely already lost some of the varieties. You know, some of the varieties are lost for good, and, you know, it isn't totally throughout, but it's here and there. And the problem is with pollen, it gets worse every year without, you know, major efforts to find isolated farms that are, you know, miles from anywhere else.
Yeah, because the wind doesn't really have borders, does it?
Yeah, the wind is the biggest challenge, and that's what we're finding. You know, it's just almost impossible in this country to find an area that has 5 or 10 miles of isolation from a corn farm. I mean, you know, even, you know, say on the edge of New York City, most likely within 10 miles, somebody has a patch of, unless you're in the middle of town, there's most likely somebody has a patch of GMO corn growing somewhere in a backyard patch or a small farm where they're making growing a little bit of corn, because it's the price of corn, it makes it worth it. Even if you only have 5 or 10 acres, a lot of farms are putting it into corn. Sure, appreciate it.
And have a great day.
Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Take care. Bye.
Jerry Gettle, owner of Baker Creek Seed Company. See what they're selling this time of year at rareseeds.com. Now we're prepping for the parsnip cakes and smoked trout recipe. As we're waiting for the griddle to heat up, let's talk parsnips. They're related to carrots, but they're richer in nutrients like potassium, and they're great for those of us growing food in the colder climates because frost actually enhances their flavor. We don't have a sous chef to help us out today, so Chef Orr has rolled up his sleeves to get the parsnips ready. Oh, you're using a little bit of elbow grease here. These don't cut easily, it looks like.
Well, the thing about a parsnip is the outside is tender, but you have this inner core, and that takes a little longer to cook. So if you're going to eat them raw, and you've got nice big ones like this, you probably want to trim around that center core and just use the exterior. But when you're boiling them, it'll all become tender in about 15 to 20 minutes.
Invest in good knives.
Good knives and good pots. That's the those are the two pieces of equipment that you really need. Everything else is just showmanship.
Parsnips. They're all steamed and ready for us.
Yeah, why don't you give these a little taste now.
Ooh, sweet. That's
very, very sweet. And you can see how that center core, it still has a little bit of toothsomeness to it, but it's tender. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to mash these up. It doesn't need to be like a real fine puree. So to this, I'm going to add a little heavy cream. Okay, we're going to add a couple of nice farm fresh eggs, add a little bit of flour to bind it, add a little bit of panko breadcrumbs. Okay, I'm going to add olive oil. And what oil or butter does in a pancake mix is it keeps the gluten from forming so you have nice, tender pancakes. All right, and we're going to add a little bit of garlic and a little lemon zest. So if you're going to make these into breakfast pancakes, you'd probably leave the garlic out, unless you're a real garlic lover.
I love garlic. Keep the garlic in.
All right, we're going to bring these over to the griddle. While those cook, we'll make the trout salad. We're going to add some diced apples, sour cream, some fennel tops. You could also use dill or tarragon. Got some horseradish. We're going to add a little fresh lemon juice to this and just a pinch of cayenne. Give it that little kick, and we're good to go. So that's how easy that is.
Wow. Just throw stuff in a bowl and stir. How are we looking on these baby pancakes?
These are looking great. Just going to let them get a little more color, because that color is caramelization. What caramelization is, it's the natural sugars within the parsnips caramelizing. So that's going to add a touch of sweetness to the pancakes, which will really play nicely off the smoked trout salad. Okay, we're going to put a little lemon garnish, a little piece of fennel on there, and those are our parsnip pancakes with smoked trout salad.
Oh, this recipe is a goodie. Find it and see pictures of the finished dish at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ahabon Binder, Teresa Bertels, Chad Bouchard, Jerry Gettle, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Chef Daniel Orr, and everyone at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all four locations and a garden center at East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, therapeutic massage and hatha yoga, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. Memberships and gift certificates available. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Stay warm out there, guys. Thanks for listening. I'm Annie Corrigan.